the size of schools, rehabilitating schools, resisting the temptation to create giant footprints to schools with all the kids having to ride on the school bus and drive the tires to school. I always say that our children are entitled to a free education, but they're not entitled to a free parking spot. Anyway, Tom will get into the physical form on that. Then after that, Tom D. Giovanni, who's from North Central California, will talk about the way that we offer schools to our children in terms of choice, choosing the school district, choosing where to live, so as to avoid the bad and going to the good. The impact that has on the life of the developer, not to mention the social justice consequences of that. And then when he's done, I will come back and tie it all together a little bit and also get more deeply into the choice issue. One that's been, I think, uniquely among groups that are related to the Smart Growth Movement, the CNU Board, I think, is the only organization that's officially on record for school choice vouchers, just to get us off of the controversial start here. With that, I would like to have Tom come forward now and make his presentation.
Thank you. One of my most enjoyable experiences every year is reporting for field trip duty with my wife, second grader. Graders at the Lincoln School in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, 21,000 people, located about 35 miles northwest of here on the Civil War. In the fall, the kids have a unit on local heroes, and here they are shown walking about 8 blocks from Lincoln School to Pottstown Borough Hall, where they visit with the Pottstown Police Department. Learn about how the policeman is your friend and so forth. Then the kids walk over about 3 blocks of the Phillies Fire Company, where the kids learn a little bit about fire safety in the home, that kind of thing. And then in the spring, just before the year is out, in fact, just last week, the kids walked over to the Pottstown Public Library, where they got their very own library card and a book that they have to return themselves during the summer. And wherever the kids walk in Pottstown, they always stop off at 222 Chestnut Street, the Hilton House, where the kids go to the bathroom, have a little healthy snack before walking on back to school. This kind of pleasant experience is made possible because my town of Pottstown is a pedestrian community, the kind, as we well know, that has not been built in the United States for about 80 years. Now, Pottstown, as you already know this from the CNU, but Pottstown is built on a walking scale, with the idea the average person can walk about 300 feet a minute. That's the length of a football field. And so if you divide a mile by 300 feet, you find the average person can walk a mile in about 17 and a half minutes. Right here in Philadelphia, that encompasses a very wide area. We're right here in Philly. Here's the Delaware. Here's the Schuylkill. And if you walk 20 minutes in any direction from where we are here in the Lowe's Hotel, you'd be walking past more retail than any mall in America. You'd be walking past millions of square feet of office space, tenants of thousands of dwelling units, schools, churches, parks, just about everything you want to do. But even in my small little town of Pottstown, within a 20-minute walk of Lincoln School, which is in the center of this circle, my wife's second graders, they can walk to Pottsgrove Manor, the home of John Potts, founder of Pottstown. They can walk to Borough Hall. They can walk to District Justice Tom Palladino's office and learn about the district justice system, the court system. They can walk to the library. They can walk to the Pottstown Post Office. They can walk to the Hill School, the private school in Pottstown, which has a center for the performing arts and puts on ballet and other programs for children. They can walk to the Pottstown High School, which also puts on programs for the elementary school kids. They can walk to the local nursing home and do little performances for the shut-ins. And they can walk to our park along the Schuylkill River here, and they can do a nature study in our park. And of course, all the kids live within 20 minutes walk of Lincoln School, so they can walk there from where they live, and also they can walk to our little downtown where we have little shops and places to socialize. And this is, of course, as we all lived in Pennsylvania through the early 1950s. We lived in villages, we lived in big cities like Philadelphia here, or we lived in small towns like my town of Pottstown, PA. And we had walkable neighborhood schools, either elementary schools, junior high schools like this one, or senior high schools.
As you know, well know, that after the Second World War, for the first time, almost everybody could afford a car. We began the Great Suburban Experiment. We're all going to move out into the countryside where we can enjoy that fresh air, have an inexpensive home, spacious yard, and made it possible through a massive highway development system. And so that 20-minute walk that I was talking about now becomes a 20-minute drive, and here's little Pottstown. So if you're willing to drive 20 minutes, you can now live in the countryside, or what was the countryside when we got started on the suburban experiment. And soon we were building tens of thousands of houses out in the countryside, and we started with retail, shopping malls, strip malls, power centers, the corporate centers out in the countryside, and then why not schools? And we started building schools out in what had been the countryside because you had lots of land to build them. And of course, we've adopted the 100% car-dependent lifestyle. Now, the anecdote to that, obviously, is smart growth. Smart growth is nothing more than saying that we ought to rediscover the traditional cities and towns that we have lived in for the last 300 years in America, certainly here in Pennsylvania. And a nice thing to rediscover would be that traditional walkable neighborhood school. When we got away from the walkable neighborhood schools, when we decided it would be a lot more efficient to build schools out in the countryside, where you could consolidate and have one great big cafeteria, one great big library, one gym, and so forth, what we didn't really think about was the ramifications of when we closed those neighborhood schools. We were taking away one of the major reasons why people lived in walkable neighborhoods in the first place. If their kid's going to get on a bus, they might as well live out in suburbia. And so what we did was degrade cities and towns throughout Pennsylvania, certainly the rest of the country, by removing those wonderful neighborhood schools. And with every passing decade, we're using more and more land for the schools we built. A famous area of Pennsylvania, Gettysburg, built a new high school about 10 years ago on 110 acres. Here is an elementary school that's about to be built on beautiful Lancaster County farmland in Pennsylvania, an 80-acre farm for one elementary school that is larger than the entire campus of Muhlenberg College in Allentown, where I went to high school. Or here's in Central York, this is south of Harrisburg, they're building a high school on 138 acres that's slightly larger than the entire main campus of the University of Pittsburgh, including the Pitt Medical Center. Our school buses in Pennsylvania now travel more than 381 million miles a year with all the traffic congestion, with all the air pollution that causes, and more than 75% of our kids in Pennsylvania are bused at a cost of a little bit more than $1 billion every year. An incredible expense, and half of it is picked up by the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And of course, all this busing is one of the things that's making obesity a leading cause of premature death in the United States. And childhood obesity, as you well know, is rising. Now, alarmed by these trends, there are a number of different groups that have started to say, you know, we ought to rediscover neighborhood schools, one of them being the Environmental Protection Agency, which put out this brochure about 3 years ago, saying that as an environmental protection of life, we really should be thinking about putting our schools back in traditional towns where people can walk there or kids can get to public transportation. I'm very pleased with this brochure, which I edited on behalf of the Pennsylvania Department of Education and the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. I have copies of this brochure free on the front chair here if anybody wants one. And what we have finally gotten the PDE in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania Department of Education, to do is say that renovating and restoring our traditional walkable schools in Pennsylvania is a really good idea. And we've got essays from very many of our Commonwealth secretaries, Secretary of Education, saying it's a lot less expensive to renovate an existing school. We have a short essay by our Secretary of Community and Economic Development saying that walkable neighborhood schools help revitalize and keep traditional towns healthy. We have an essay by our Secretary of Environmental Protection, Katie McGinney, saying that the greenest building you can do is the building you already have, the one you don't have to build, by restoring the school you've got. An essay by our Secretary of Health saying that walkable schools obviously are good for student health, that kids can walk there. An essay by our Secretary of Transportation in Pennsylvania saying the same thing. We really want to encourage kids to walk and ride their bicycle to school so we wouldn't have all this enormous busing. And we have essays by other experts. This is a guy from the Council of Educational Facility Planners International pointing out that despite the myth a well-built building can last indefinitely, can last actually centuries. If it's maintained every 20 or 30 years, it gets a major renovation to it. And certainly from an educational point of view, small schools, kids do much better in small schools than big schools, especially low and moderate income children. Now, what are some of the reasons that have been given for abandoning these neighborhood schools? One is economies of scale. This nice little neighborhood school just doesn't cut it economically. What we have to do is close them down and put a school out in a cornfield. This is a lovely little borough in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, called Mount Joy. It used to have two elementary schools, 100% walkable elementary schools, and they built a new one out here on 40 acres in the farmland. We're not only kids that they can't walk, but they are strictly actually forbidden by the school district to try to walk there, despite the fact that there have been a lot of studies saying that kids do better in small schools and that economically they do just as well as larger schools. There was a study done about 10 years ago by the Vermont Department of Education, and they found that kids in small schools do much better academically than those in larger schools, especially kids from low-income families. There's more family participation. There's more student participation in activities. That if you have a school smaller than 100 kids, which is a really small school, it's 6 to 12% more annually to operate. But once you get to 120 kids, which is a very small school, they became as cost-effective as the largest elementary schools in Vermont. In fact, large elementary schools have diseconomies of scale. The late Ernest Boyer, who had been the president of the Carnegie Foundation of Teaching, wrote a book about the ideal elementary school. On his behalf, the National Association of Elementary School Principals surveyed its membership, and they found that a whopping, 82% thought that an elementary school should have fewer than 500 kids. A significant number, 38%, thought an elementary school should have fewer than 300 children. Breaking ranks are done by the Carnegie Foundation and the National Association of Secondary School Teachers recommends that high schools should have no more than 600 kids. Of course, you probably know Bill Gates thinks a high school shouldn't have any more than 400 kids. So small schools are very good places for kids to learn. And it's not just children. The best-selling business book of the 20th century, In Search of Excellence by Peters and Waterman, had a whole chapter on scale. And in there they say, after this whole chapter, they conclude that regardless of industry, you put more than 500 people under one roof and you start to have substantial and unanticipated problems, even for the most cost-oriented companies. A small is more productive and more innovative. So it just seems to be a factor of human nature that we need to be in small groups. A common reason given in Pennsylvania is the school wears out. It's just too old, 75 years old. Man, we got to tear that down and put in a new school. It's just absolutely ridiculous. This is my alma mater, Kutztown University, about 50 miles from here. This is the old main. It consists of five different buildings, all wood frame. Built more than 100 years ago. This is not only a classroom building, it's also a dormitory full of kids who think they're immortal and do stupid things. And despite that fact, this is a perfectly safe dormitory and classroom building, fully sprinkled, all automated, very high energy efficiency system, actually got a rebate from the local utility company for energy conservation. So if you can make a dormitory safe, you can certainly make a classroom building safe. One of the laughable things in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure you see this throughout the United States, is that they'll say a school is too old to be safe for children. It's too old to be safe for kids who are having fire drills and who are awake and supervised all year long, but it's safe enough to make it elderly housing. So then they close it down, and they put in the elderly, infirm people, you know, with their walkers who are cooking and sleeping there, and they say that's safe. You have really probably a couple of hundred schools that have been turned into elderly housing in Pennsylvania. I always like to point out the example of Bruges, Belgium. Bruges being an unusual European city because it missed all the wars. You know, nobody ever bombed it, nobody ever invaded it, and so it's totally intact. And every picture, every building you see in this picture is at least 300 years old. This is the clock tower of Bruges, happened to be built the same year that Columbus discovered America, 1492. And the difference between this clock tower and the average school built in Pennsylvania in the early 20th century is that our schools were built to much higher standards than the Bruges clock tower. Cost, that's always another factor. It costs too much to renovate. Now, this is a perfect example. This is a beautiful middle school in a little town called Hanover, Pennsylvania, that they abandoned because it was going to cost too much money to fix it. This magnificent civic monument in this small town with this absolutely breathtaking auditorium, they abandoned in order to replace it with a one-story piece of junk on the edge of town. Now, could the school have been renovated? Well, we know it could because it has a twin in my town of Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Exactly the same year, both built in 1933, same floor plate, same construction technique. The only thing that's different, we have a nicer cupola on our school than we have on theirs. So we renovated our school, and we found that, and we put an addition, actually too big of an addition, we put an addition on the back, and you can see the renovations were $170 a square foot, and the addition was $135. It was actually cheaper to renovate the building we have. And this is a civic monument in Pottstown. This is by far the most beautiful school building, and it's something that greatly enhances the quality of our town. Roofs wear out, walls, windows, doors, HVAC systems, and so forth, but the foundation and the walls of a well-built building are never going to wear out, and it's always going to be cheaper, even if you have to gut the thing, it's always going to be cheaper to rehab a school rather than build a new one. In fact, we finally managed to pry out of the Department of Education statistics. They only went back 3 years, but that's $3 billion worth of school construction, and we found that new construction in Pennsylvania in the last 3 years, for structure costs, $152 a square foot, renovation, $96 a square foot, 60% more to build new than to renovate. Now that's structure cost. If you start to get the whole project cost in, which we were talking about buying the land and all that kind of stuff, it's more than twice as expensive to build a new school than to renovate the one you have. And the chances are, if the school was built prior to 1950, the one you're renovating is to a much, much higher standard than the one that you're going to build new. Need for space. I always like this one. We need lots and lots of space for that school. What do we need the space for? Well, we need it for athletic fields, because certainly nobody could ever share a field. You know, you've got to have one for every individual sport. And then, of course, because you've made it so big, you need a lot of room for detention basins. And then because it's in the middle of nowhere, you've got a gigantic parking lot, and so that's why you have a high school that needs 110 acres. Now, the reason why we have all these athletic fields, of course, is for kids to get healthy exercise. But now I ask you, how many of these kids are going to be playing football when they're in their 20s? How many of these girls are going to be playing softball when they're 25 or 30 years old? The answer is less than 1%. But walking, that is something you're going to do from the time you're a little tot until you're ready to lay down and die. So if we're really interested in exercise, you ought to have walkable neighborhood schools. Aerobics, let me not get sidetracked by that. Surgeon General says a kid should have 60 minutes of exercise a day. Well, walking to and from school will give them most of the exercise they need if they're just walking to school. And of course, the pathetic thing is to go around our cities and towns or our suburban areas and see these dismal gyms. I can't imagine anywhere I would be less likely to want to spend time. Or you can whip out your personal fitness center, you know, at the office and run a few laps on the treadmill. But the best way to get exercise is just to live in a traditional town where you walk places and you get the exercise in the course of daily life. This is my alma mater, 1916 William Allen High School in Allentown, Pennsylvania. It's an enormous school, 450,000 square feet, and it's on just 6.5 acres. Well, where are the athletic fields? Where are the kids going to exercise? Well, we have the athletic fields scattered throughout the city of Allentown. This is William Allen. This is the city of Allentown, city of 100,000 people, and the blue stars are various practice fields that the kids go to. You know what? They're athletes. They can walk. So this is where we have the various practice fields, and so if you need to bus some kids to some distant field, better to bus 30 athletes than bus 3,000 kids every day for a handful of athletes. This is the Palmerton Elementary School, a little girl we have in Palmerton, postage stamp lot, a no room for a playground. What do they do? Well, right across the street is the Palmerton Municipal Park. The kids just walk across the street. They have a little playground in their section of the park, and then they walk back to school. Another reason given is we got rid of, that old school because it doesn't fit the modern instructional program. That is, it doesn't meet the latest fad. Now, this was the fad in the 70s, building schools without windows. that makes all our schools look like jails. I can't imagine a more depressing place for an elementary school kid to go. And yet, regrettably, we have hundreds of these schools in Pennsylvania. And now we have learned that these are not more energy efficient, that because of advances in window glass technology, it's much more energy efficient to have lots of natural daylighting, which is also, studies have shown, not surprisingly, that kids do well where you have lots of natural light in the classroom. This is the newest elementary school in my town of Pottstown, not very new, built 1969, and the fad then was grouping kids together, schools without walls. So you would put four classrooms together and you'd have these folding walls so that all, like 120 kids could have a lesson together, a true prescription for chaos. So anyway, they put these together, and what they found is oftentimes when they open the wall, they can't close it again. You know? So they're reluctant to do that. Of course, you can't hang anything on it because it's a folding wall, and they're paper thin, and so you can't hear anything. So this is actually the most obsolete school in this district, the one that was supposed to be modern. This is a school without walls. This was just last week in the Reading Eagle in Reading, Pennsylvania. They're finally going to put walls back in. After 30 years of failure, they've decided to put walls back into the building. My friend Yale Spencer in Maryland, just a real block from me one day, from six schools off the top of his head that they built without walls, and within 5 years they put the walls back in. You know, that's your modern educational program. Now, this is the oldest elementary school in Pottstown, St. Aloysius Elementary School, built in 1912, and in my estimation, it is the warmest, coziest, most friendly elementary school in our borough by far. A wonderful place to learn, and yet they never had to really rearrange anything on the inside. Energy efficiency. We have a LEED certified elementary school, Hanover School District. It's also one of the most bizarre looking elementary schools I've ever seen. But you know, you don't have to build something new to make it energy efficient. This is the first elementary school in Pennsylvania. First elementary school in Pennsylvania to have geothermal heat pumps. This is a very close to being a LEED certified building. Each classroom has its own heat pump for heating and cooling. Uses much less than the average amount of energy in a public school in Pennsylvania. These are two other older schools. This one built in 1937, this one built in 1928. All high energy efficient school buildings. This was a parking garage that was taken by a private school, St. Stephen's Episcopal Cathedral School. They ran out of room. They were actually in this house. And as they grew, they ran out of room and they were thinking about moving out of Harrisburg. Behind the house was a parking garage. This is now a LEED certified school building. They renovated the parking garage as a school. Now, it's not only a LEED certified as far as the fact that it's very energy efficient, but it's also, that's a before picture. This is after. This is the kids going into the school. But they have used the city of Harrisburg, our state capital, of course, a very enriched city, for their classroom space. Here's the school right here. There is no library at the school. They use the Dauphin County Library. There is no gymnasium. They use the Pine Street Presbyterian Street Gymnasium up here. There's no park. They use Riverfront Park along the Susquehanna River for their playground every day. And up here, there's a YMCA just outside of the picture that they use for their gym. So the city of Harrisburg becomes part of the classroom experience. Demolishing a building creates far more waste than new construction creates a tremendous amount of waste from demolition. It's a lot less expensive and better for the environment to renovate what you have, and renovations are far more labor intensive, dollar for dollar. So if you build a new building, a lot of your money is going into new steel and brick and materials, whereas if you're renovating, a lot of your money is going into labor, which is a good thing for your local labor force. We do have some very good examples of adaptive reuse in Pennsylvania. This is a former bank and farmer's market that's been turned into an elementary school in the city of Reading, Pennsylvania. The gym is the former farmer's market, probably the only elementary school gym with a skylight in Pennsylvania. This is the school under renovation. This is an 1850s cotton warehouse in the city of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, that was turned into the Carter and McRae Elementary School. The elementary school is in the first two floors. The upper floors are administration and storage space. That's just the layout of the school. They put the cafeteria and the gymnasium on an addition in the back. But they saved this wonderful warehouse, landmark building in Lancaster, and it's right where the kids are in the downtown, a totally 100% walkable school. This is a former YWCA in downtown Harrisburg, which is now SciTech High, high school for 400 kids in the city. And the kids here are all issued passes on the municipal bus system. Okay, let me skip around towards the end. Even as sprawled as we are, we've got 41% of our trips are less than 2 miles, which means it should be theoretically possible for most of our kids to walk or ride a bicycle to school, even the way we are, if we try and retrofit our infrastructure to have walkable schools. This is the Stellar School District in Pennsylvania. It's a very affluent school district south of Pittsburgh called Mount Lebanon. It's a totally 100% walkable school. All their elementary schools are strategically placed throughout the municipality to be 100% walkable. They have all been systematically renovated. And most of these schools go back to the 1920s. This is a chart showing that they've all been systematically renovated recently to be walkable. So this brochure that I have out here, if you're interested in getting a copy, again, we talk about the fact in Pennsylvania, we have no acreage requirements for schools in Pennsylvania, that it's less expensive to renovate than to build new, that an older building, especially one built from 1900 to 1940, is much better built than what we're doing today, and will have a longer lifespan. You can continue to keep renovating it. It's better for the environment to renovate a building than build new. That bottom picture is a former hospital that's being turned into a high school in the city of Reading. That you can have a 21st century instructional program in the traditional school buildings, the SciTech High right here. And that you get your community character from school buildings. And I thank you very much for having me.
Let me actually start a bit as we're getting the slides pulled together. I have about 10 slides here. I want to take just a few minutes to tell a couple of stories. If I can move this to the first slide, that would be helpful. Well, let me tell a couple of stories. I'm a developer in Northern California. California differs a bit, at least from the state of Pennsylvania, in that my region of California, the Central Valley of California, there is expected to be 10 million additional people in the next 40 years. Actually, in the next 35 years. It's the Central Valley, and there is a need, in fact, for new schools. So as a developer, I've got the challenge of trying to coax local school boards and school districts and school constituents, that is, parents and civic leaders and the like, to think in terms of smaller schools. Now, let me give you a couple of stories here, if I could. One story really has to do with a project in the town of the city of Chico, California, about a city of about 100,000 folks, we have a project that we proposed on about 200 acres, adjacent to two existing schools. At the time, though, the city of Chico had just voted about 4 years earlier, 3 or 4 years earlier, to raise about $50 million for a new third high school. It was going to be the first high school built in the city in about 30 years, 35 years, actually. And, of course, what they're dealing with in the state of California is our minimum school standards, site standards, for elementary schools of 10 to 18 acres, junior high schools of about 18 to 24 acres, and high schools anywhere from 35 to 55 acres. You mentioned the University of Pennsylvania. Harvard Yards on 25 acres. There are 1,600 college students who live there, not just go to school there. And there's probably another 3,000 who actually, during the daytime, are attending classes in Harvard Yard. Oh, and by the way, there's a church there and a 4 million book library as well. So we have plenty of examples to kind of show in very stark terms how wasteful this tends to be. When we undertook a charrette, can I have that slide back? When it was time to run a charrette back in 2003, I quickly bought up a couple dozen of books on small schools put out by the Gates, or funded by the Gates Foundation. This is at the time, of course, people were beginning to talk more and more about small schools, not only due to the efforts of folks like Tom at the grassroots level and smart growth advocates, but this was just a few years after, as you can all remember, Columbine. And people were doing a lot of soul searching after Columbine, and they were no longer talking just about the notion of small classrooms, which had been the item that folks had talked about for about 10 years earlier, that the way to excellence in education was a small classroom. After Columbine, the notion of small schools, which had been around, gained further currency. So what we did, actually, in addition to handing out that book and inviting the school board members to the charrette, is to try to change their notion of what a high school could look like. And we took one of the lead designer on the project was Leo Creer, who is sort of the intellectual godfather of New Urbanism, the man who brought Andres Duany low one time back in the early 80s, as he talked about how Andres really was beginning himself at the time when he had a very flashy firm called Arquitectonica in Miami, was doing essentially the wrong stuff. So Leo actually had urged us to create a matrix that you see here, 8 acres, 4 acres, and 2 acres, based on, you know, what would a high school program use? Well, here's all the programs. Here are all the program elements of a school, or the physical elements dealing with program: classroom, a library, a gymnasium, larger classrooms, even a parking lot down here, and play fields, whether it's an indoor basketball court, outdoor basketball court, or a larger field. And down one axis, we had 400 students, 800 students, or 1,200 students, even greater than what Gates recommends, the Gates Foundation recommends for high schools, 8, 4, and 2 acres. And as you can see, it's not necessary to have all those elements, and it's actually impossible to have all those elements when you have a small site. But as Tom mentioned earlier, when you are building in robust urbanism, you don't need all of that because that is available to be shared in other locales. So we felt we had made some progress in the charrette to try to change the mind of the local school district, and we had some very excited conversations at the time. But once again, you know, once a charrette, for any of you who have experienced a charrette, it's a very heady period, very exciting time, and then people go home. And the next time we heard from the school district, after some attempts to further engage them on this, they bought a 50-acre site, not a 40-acre site. And so I guess I'm telling you about, if you will, what I would call a failure, but that there's, from our perspective, no reason to give up the fight. What we then did with the two local or adjacent elementary schools is to simply put additional civic resources adjacent to them, a neighborhood park adjacent to the elementary school, and so that its resources and its fields could be used by the neighbors as well as the children. So it became essentially a shared use facility. I'm going to apologize here. I think we've loaded the wrong file. I don't have any other anything else to show you at this point. I would add one thing, though. Over the last 10 years, John Anderson, who some of you may have heard discussed today, the battles that have to take place at the local level to achieve victories over such things as smaller scale streets, slower streets, safe streets, and the same with park standards and the like. All of the civic elements, streets, parks, and schools. We talk about big box, we talk about sprawl as though it were just a private sector problem. And to be sure, it is in some fundamental ways a private sector problem. But at the very least, public sector decision makers have made decisions that only exacerbate that, and schools are one of those things. It took 10 years, actually closer to 15 years, for the CNU to be knocking on the door of the Institute of Traffic Engineers and the Association of State Highway Traffic Engineers, engineers at the national level. It takes developers and advocates at the local level to bring those changes to bear on streets or on parks or on schools. And in the state of California, we still do have these minimum standards, but I think it is analogous. And it's analogous that these are the same sorts of problems, only tougher, though, with respect to schools than we have with streets and parks. But it will take hopefully another decade to have the kind of effect that needs to happen in a state like California or in a region like the Central Valley, where 10 million folks will be moving in over the next couple generations. And with that, I'll leave the rest to the conversation. Thank you very much.